Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Lynn Elliott.
And I'm Layla Bernard.
And you are listening to the Sleepover Podcast.
Yes, coming to you live is our first episode from Carolyn's new house.
Yeah, we're here at the new house. We got Rory with us. Bruce is here. David's walking around with Lulu. My stepsons are here, so you might hear some family noises around.
Yes, welcome to reality.
What we wanted to talk about today was, you know, David has been in this deep exploration about the relationship of the words thelema and rain till runa, which is the word of the rune guild mega Stephen Flowers.
I'm super excited about this conversation, Carolyn, and I also feel like it bears sharing about, like, the conversation and the insistence that you had about Aleister Crowley's role as, like, an evil redeemer, because there may still be people who listen to this podcast who are like, well, Carolyn and Layla are pretty cool, and, like, they seem pretty on it, but, like, I don't know about that Crowley guy. He's a real jerk. And I don't know if you want to share about that, but I'm putting you on the spot, so you'll have to say no in front of everyone.
I'll share about it. So basically, David and I got into a bit of a debate, passionate debate about wherein I cried and yelled a lot.
Those masterful rhetorical strategies of rage.
About, you know, him feeling that, you know, there's just something unwholesome about Aleister Crowley. He was just, you know, he was a heroin addict. He was a real jerk to pretty much everybody he ever met. He was very self-centered. He was not a good father, very neglectful father, into some very weird, gross-out tantric practices. One occasion, I think he ate some of the feces of one of his lovers.
Woo!
I think there were some times when...
There's a great poem everyone should look up called Lee Sublime.
Lee Sublime.
L-E-A-H. Sublime.
L-E-A-H. Leah. Not Lee.
Leah Sublime.
Leah.
It's about poop eating.
Leah Hersig.
It's about all the things that they did at
Okay.
Leah.
Yes,
it's check about, it out. Check it out. It's
yes, Leah Sublime about Leah Hersig. That's so funny that he pronounces Leah as Lee. Anyways, but he yes, at the Abbey of Thelema, Cephalou in Sicily, some stuff went down. Some people claim that Crowley made them drink cat blood and they got super sick and maybe died.
Some deeply antinomian things were going on.
Very, very. What else happened? Crowley, at least according to his own magical diary, was engaging in, you know, some behaviors with animals that are beyond the pale, that are not, definitely not kosher. I don't even want to, anyways. But yes.
Basically, it would be understandable to have a negative opinion of this character.
Yes. So, like, David was coming with the argument of, like, you know, Aleister Crowley is nobody's role model. Nobody should want to be like Crowley. He was a real mess up. He really just screwed up his life in so many ways and was such a jerk and was weird. And I was like, you know what? I still love him and I still believe he was amazing. I don't care what you say. And finally, and David was like, well, why? Why is he so amazing? Why do you think he's so... And I was like, look, okay, let's talk about this. He identified as... So, I wonder if there's a way we could give Brucey some toy or something that would be make him less into the yelling. Me personally. Okay.
Carolyn's quotes of David with a grain of salt because she says things about me when I'm not there to argue on behalf of the point that I was making, so they're always out of context.
Wasn't the point that Crowley. Your point was
that
Crowley
was.
Anyway, the exact details of the argument are less important than the conclusion. Of the argument.
Okay, so get into the conclusion of the argument. So finally, after I was just, you know, because I just had this sense, in my heart. There's something wonderful and magical about Thelema. I don't care. And David just, you know, by being so, committed to his view.
Aquarian,
Taurus rising, Aquarius sun, etc. six planets in Capricorn. The man can really dig in. So drew out of me this thing that I had not yet consciously articulated to myself, which is, I'll try to explain it, that Crowley essentially brought forth an archetype of wholeness into conscious realization for the Western mind that had not been previously achieved. And the way that he did that was by volunteering to situate himself within what we could call the mandala of Christ. Like, if we consider Jesus Christ at the center of the Western esoteric tradition, with all the ancient Egyptian and Babylonian and Judaic and Greek stuff behind him, and then his life and crucifixion, and then everything that radiated out from that, all of the, you know, both the beautiful things and also the Inquisition and the witch hunts and the sort of miserable patriarchy times. We see this kind of mandala that includes not just Jesus Christ, but also, you know, people intimately connected to him, the disciples, Mary Magdalene, Mother Mary, Joseph, the people that he healed, Judas, Pontius Pilate, King Herod, the people involved in his death, and going out very far to the furthest reaches of the New Testament. In the book of Revelations, we have the characters of, you know, the great beast, 666, and the Antichrist. And I need to reread the book of Revelations.
Not to mention Babylon.
And Babylon, yeah. Babylon rides the beast. Well, so yes. There's two beasts of Revelation, one of whom Babylon rides. And there's the beast, and there's, I think the beast is like the herald of the Antichrist, if I'm remembering correctly. So, nobody else was volunteering to identify themselves with the great beast. And anyways, I think it was a crucial move that Crowley did that he magically, mythically, poetically said, you know what? It's me. I'm that asshole. I am so into, you know, the material sins of this world. I have my own little freaky heretical religion called Thelema. I do all these weird things. Everybody knows I'm a jerk. You know, like Jesus Christ. What
have you widely understood to not be a jerk.
Widely understood to be the opposite of a jerk. Widely understood for thousands of years to be this archetype of complete and entire goodness.
Right.
You know, like the Catholic Church was always saying, like, he who was without sin. You know, and of course there's all these stories, like wherever he went, he healed people, he made them feel better, he resurrected them from the dead, resurrected himself from the dead, always giving blessings, always being super cool.
Super nice.
Super nice. Just what a guy. What a
stand-up guy. Stand-up guy.
Feeding people, giving them wine. Aleister Crowley, not. Not what a guy.
Not
You'd
that.
Meet Aleister Crowley and your immediate response would not be like, oh my God, what an awesome.
I'm in the presence of a saint.
Guy. Yeah, no. You wouldn't think that. You would think like, whoa, you know, this guy seems really into himself. He's really got a lot of weird stuff going on. And anyhow, Crowley basically, nobody would accuse him of being without sin. Let's say that.
Yes.
So, what I find very interesting, so Crowley channeled the Book of the Law in 1904. I'm not exactly sure when he started identifying himself publicly as the Great Beast. I need to research that. We do know that his mother sort of always teasingly called him that. But right before he channeled the Book of the Law, he found the Stele of Revealing, which was number 666, I believe, in the French Egyptological Museum, where they found it in Cairo. Rose led him to it. Inspired by beings who they had invoked in the Great Pyramid. And he saw this stele of revealing 666, and he immediately like resonated with his own mother identifying himself as the beast 666. He'd grown up in the Plymouth Brethren, which was a sect very focused on the Book of Revelations, very sort of ascetic, judgy sect of Christianity, and his mother was very unhappy, and he had a very bad relationship with his mother due to her being so unhappy. just for some context, everybody. So that, so also think about it, the Stele of Revealing and the Book of Revelations, like revealing, revealing, revelations, revelations. That's a major theme for Crowley. And I, what I'm saying, and I, so I'm laying this out for you now, and I want to write off this whole essay about it when I make myself focus, is that Crowley had a giant magical success. You know, whatever, like, you could talk all kinds of shit about Thelema, like, it's not that popular of a religion or a philosophy. There's only maybe, like, I don't know, less than 10,000 people worldwide who are really into it. You know, you could make all these arguments of, like, oh, he wasn't that impactful, he wasn't that successful. I mean, I think those arguments are a little bit silly because, like, basically everything having to do with, like, the current psychedelic renaissance that we have can be traced back very neatly to Aleister Crowley and his influence on people like John Lennon. And anyhow, there's an argument that can be, that I've heard many people who I respect and love speak dismissively of Aleister Crowley. So, I mean, I think that, for example, I think that, Jonathan Michael Greer is amazing. Jonathan Michael Greer is a well-respected, brilliant guy who obviously has deep spiritual illumination from Golden Dawn style practices. And I forget which interview I was listening to him recently, but he was like, you know, somebody asked him about Aleister Crowley, and he basically, like, you'd hear him rolling his eyes. Like, he was like, what a joke, you know, that
guy. Yeah, everyone wants to not be associated with him, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And it's understandable, given, like, what we just talked about, Aleister Crowley was not a wholesome person. But what I'm saying is that, so 1904. 1904, he channeled the Book of the Law, had this deep experience with the 666 Stele of Revealing. We'll just conjecture that's around when he started publicly identifying as the Great Beast. I guess that was in the Book of the Law. Like, the Book of the Law referred to him as the Beast. Anyhow, 1910, Carl Jung starts publishing. I believe it was 6 years after Crowley's death. So Crowley died in 1955. So I'm bad at math. So
that's 61.
Or 1945. So 1951. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that was when Carl Jung published Aeon. So Aeon, spelled A-I-O-N, Aeon was the name of the lion-headed god. So the lion-headed god associated with Mithraic mysteries, who was thought to represent basically like the great god of eternity, who was like outside of the created world, like beyond it, and is an archetype of like complete wholeness, like this lion. So it's like a man's body with this serpentine tail wrapped around it, culminating in this lion's head, often with wings, often holding a scepter. So Jung's argument in the book Aeon is sort of just what we've been talking about, that like the Christ archetype was too one-sided, that created all sorts of problems.
Cast a big shadow.
Big, big-ass shadow there.
World-disrupting shadow.
Yes, which is not really exactly Jesus' fault, more like the Catholic Church and other institutions, but like cast a big, big shadow. And of course, when this archetype of complete sinlessness, of total goodness, is being held up as like what everybody should emulate. Obviously then people, you know, there's various reactions to that. People get very ashamed of whatever sinfulness they detect in themselves, sexual desire, bodily stuff, etc. And they get very willing to project the opposite of goodness, very, very badness, lots and lots of wrongness, onto other people, onto, you know, whole groups of other people, which they then happily murder. So it's messed up. And so, you know, Jung argues that Christ and Antichrist together make up a complete archetype of wholeness, of the whole self. and they're essentially brothers, and they are like, actually, you know, you can't really have one without the other. There's no way. It's impossible. It's two sides of the same coin. So obviously, Carl Jung was brilliant. Obviously, he contributed so much to our understanding of the psyche and hermeticism, alchemy, magic, all of that. Really made it accessible to people in the modern era. One could say he was a more influential magician, maybe, than Crowley. But what occurred to me recently, and which I said to David, is like, I don't think it would have been possible for that thought to come to Carl Jung and all of his understanding about the self with a capital S and all of his understanding about the union of opposites and how, you know, that all works, unless Crowley had done this great, actually quite self-sacrificial feat of volunteering to play the role of the great beast 666, herald of the Antichrist. He immanentized the eschaton. So
he did it.
He did it. So that was like a catchphrase. I feel like was it Terence McKenna who used to talk about that? I feel like definitely Terence McKenna talked about that, immanentizing the eschaton. He brought it down to earth. He embodied it and he lived it dramatically. And, you know, he referred to his magical partners, his lovers, as these scarlet women, identifying them with Babylon. And he wrote all of this amazing stuff about Babylon and the beast. And basically really did his part to contribute to actually the fulfillment of Christianity, the fulfillment of the prophecies of the New Testament, which is why I do think that Thelema is a form of Christic Gnosticism. So I feel like that was a huge achievement and a huge thing that Crowley did for all of us. And sure, you don't want to personally emulate him if you want to have a healthy, happy, wholesome life. But still, like,
somehow it, like, makes a healthy, happy, wholesome life, like, more possible when, like, there is the dual-sided God presence. Because then it's possible to, like, hold all things in love and admiration and forgiveness and grace, as opposed to just having, like, the one-sided thing and being like, well, everything that's not that is, like, complete shit and we're totally justified in hating it.
Yeah, because, like, Jesus preached forgiveness and you can't actually forgive if you're having that attitude. Like,
correct.
You can only have an attitude of, like, unconditional love and forgiveness when you actually can see the beauty of everything, the wholeness of everything. And, truly. And I feel like Crowley really did excel at that. Like, he really excelled at, like, celebrating the nasty, yucky parts of life and seeing the beauty in them.
Well, and it's like his personal character may have been the beast and, like, this sort of antichrist yucky man. And yet, like, his work is about wholeness and, like, is about reconciliation and is about, like, the union of the operating creative forces of the world, which are creation and destruction and, like, total expansiveness and, like, total contractedness. And, like, you can see in the, like, fruit of his mind that he was not simply obsessed with debauch.
Right. Yes. That there were definitely higher impulses in Crowley. I mean, exactly. Right. So, like, it's easy to characterize him as somebody obsessed with debauch, given that he did have a whole lot of sex and did a whole lot of drugs. But he also, like, selflessly, you know, in many ways, like, gave away everything he ever realized, everything he ever thought. He did his best to write it down, communicate it. He spent all of his money publishing editions of books, like, to try to communicate to others, like, what he himself had found. And, you know, like, in one way you could say that, well, that was just a vanity press, like him publishing the Equinox. But he really had this, I don't think it was. It has not proved to be that. There are people like Lawnmiller Duquette, for example, who is like, I feel like by anybody's definition, a saint. Like, I feel like you cannot actually interact with Lon and come away from that being like, whatever, just a regular guy. No, like, Lon is like so sweet, so warm, so present, so, you know, like, you can feel him like tenderly feeling all of the world. And yeah, he's not a monk. He's like a guy with a family in California. But like, anyways, Lon is so wholesome and so sweet and so special, and got there through, you know, in large part, his engagements with Thelema and the writings of Aleister Crowley and the Book of Thoth and everything. And I feel like there is... So my sense is that Crowley truly did succeed in wrapping up, you know, what he called the Aeon of Osiris, this period of like 2000... a couple hundred years following the death of Christ, that was like the age of Pisces, and preparing us for the age of Aquarius. And what I also think is really interesting, so like precessions of the equinox wise, we're still, I think, a couple hundred years away from actually like the spring equinox happening in Aquarius. But of course, you could argue that it's like a cusp in astrology. And that, I mean, he certainly did. He certainly thought that we were in the new aeon. But something that I've been thinking about is how, in one way, perhaps, you know, so Crowley spelled aeon, A-E-O-N, like an era or a world. And I think there's a certain sense in which, yes, there's that, we're in that, and we're also in a new aeon, A-I-O-N, like the lion-headed god. Because, you know, like somebody who talks about this a lot is, so Damien Eccles talks about how, you know, in the various eras for the various, where the spring equinox was in various places, you see a lot of symbolism associated with that animal. So like the Mithraic mysteries, the age of Taurus, the bull imagery, the you know, Hebraic Judeo mysteries, like being very like about Aries and the ram and the sacrifice of the ram, obviously like Jesus, Pisces, the fishes,
Fisher of men, accomplisher of the miracle of the loaves and the fishes, just to give some metaphorical examples.
Yeah, I think there's a way in which the argument could be made that probably the last time that humanity really had active in its mind the archetype of complete wholeness, represented by Aeon, the lion-headed god, was perhaps the age of Leo, which would have been when Leo was on the, you know, rising at the spring equinox. And that would have been the time that people associate with Atlantis. And I've heard very interesting people like Matthias DiStefano, who says that he remembers all of his past lives, including past lives in Atlantis, talk about how there's this like kind of direct communication going on where there's like information from the people of Atlantis from that era trying to reach us now here on the other side at Aquarius and communicate, you know, important things, I guess, to avoid civilizational destruction or something, which, gee whiz, it sure would be nice if we didn't implode ourselves. Speaking of civilizational destruction, Layla and I live in Pittsburgh, where for the past 3 days, we've been blanketed in smoke from wildfires in Canada.
Yeah.
And this is crazy. I mean, I heard about all the wildfires on the West Coast, but the fact that Pittsburgh is now afflicted is rough.
Shocking, yeah.
So the world is literally on fire.
Like, yeah, revelation is happening.
It's happening. So, Anyhow, where was I? So a new aeon, a new realization of the lion-headed god, a new realization of the archetype of wholeness that includes both Christ and Antichrist. Speaking of Antichrist, Jack Parsons identified himself as the Antichrist. He was like, ah, yes.
That is me.
That's me. Aleister Crowley was the great beast. I'm the Antichrist. And, you know, of course, there's lots of candidates for the Antichrist. I'm sure lots of people would love to nominate Elon Musk. I don't know.
In the great mandala, we all could be a little Antichrist. And there's definitely more than one. And it's really not a necessarily has to be like a personal moniker. But yeah, willing to embody the frequency of that character.
Yeah, and poetically take it on as part of their legacy. And I guess I just have admiration for that, because on the surface, you know, it seems like a bit of a goofy, self-aggrandizing thing to do. But when you really think about it, having publicly identified as the beast or as the Antichrist makes people always look at you sideways for the rest of history. Like, it does have an effect on your legacy. It makes, you know, makes conventional Christians quite suspicious of you, for example. So anyhow.
Well, and it is interesting to think about, to contemplate, you know, Jack Parsons' role in creating, you know, the technologies that sent humanity to space, which is a super Aquarian theme of the last 100 years, probing space, you know, light speed communications technologies. All kinds of, you know, now we're living in the age of realized AI intelligences. All pretty Aquarian stuff. Pretty far out there, Aquarian, Uranian type things.
Yes.
I mean, Jack Parsons sent humanity to the moon.
Yes.
So, I mean, to space in a more generalized sense. Made it possible. So, you know, the changing of the aeon.
The changing of the aeon. So, yeah, so that, so I explained all this to David, and he was like, oh, okay, you're right. You should write a book about that. I was like, thanks, I know I'm right. You could have just gone with the proposition all along that I was right and not argued with me at all.
But then would you have really articulated it, Carolyn? So in that way, David himself was generously and lovingly taking on the role of the beast and the antagonist and the bad guy in order to bring about a realization of wholeness. So
it's true.
Can you really blame him?
It's true. No.
Innocent and without fault.
He's absolutely innocent. Totally good. Yeah, so that's just been a fun thing that I've been thinking about lately, and I do look forward to writing it all out. And so, I don't know, should we even talk about the next thing, or should we save that for another episode? Maybe let's just, like, stick with this theme that we have, like, come to now, which is I want to let everybody know there's a totally free audiobook version of Jung's Aeon on YouTube, which you can listen to, and highly recommend. What else? Yeah, I know what I want to talk about. Okay, so like Jesus Christ, totally great guy.
Totally great.
2,000 something years of a lot of stuff being messed up following the appearance of
his very name. In his very great and kind name, atrocities have been done.
And I find it very interesting. I was reading, I think, one of David's books on Taoism, I think maybe a Domo Mitchell book, and he was talking about how, like, you know, kind actions don't necessarily precipitate kind results.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Like, there's a way in which somebody being that awesome necessarily invokes a counterbalance of 2,000 years of way not awesome. And there's, yes, like, you know, there's this interesting dynamic in the world. And so anyhow, what I think is interesting is that luckily for us, fairly recently, Aleister Crowley was a giant asshole. And I feel like that the way that ripples through as I was talking about when I was talking about Lon's saintliness, I think has to do with that there can be beneficial ripples and beneficial results actually from somebody being quite seemingly selfish and awful.
Well, it's like Faust's quote from, what is it? Yeah, so the Goethe's quote from Faust. Goethe's quote from Faust where, you know, evil is the force that always wills. Well, so he's asking, Mephistopheles is asking Faust, who are you? And he says, well, I am part of that force that always wills the evil and always produces the good, which is the interesting corollary to, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The road to heaven, then by, you know, opposite analogy, must be paved with naughty intentions. Yes. And like being nasty and bad. And I think that that's really true. And it also ties in with, you know, the thing that we will talk about on the next podcast, which is, you know, David's contemplations of the Rain Till Runa, which explores sort of the having is evidence of wanting, wanting is evidence of having, these sort of like right and left-handed shakings of each other that are like these chiral twins of truth that like somehow ultimate goodness and like the lifting up of ultimate goodness and pure purity, innocence in the form of Christ has seemed to work a lot of evil. Mm-hmm. Whereas paradoxically, like the allowance of debauch and unwholesomeness and like just the relaxed holding of that as something not to be afraid of or like shied away from or repressed or hated seems to have like awoken in society some reconciliation and like chilling the fuck out and like generally more equality and like less evil.
Right, because it removes the need, like when one is receptive to like grok this archetype of wholeness, it removes the need to project evil outside of ourselves.
Right.
Like, and like it's very interesting for me and very I find it like very connected to what we were talking about a while ago with like Ken Wilber and like integral consciousness and
yeah.
like even like integral political consciousness. Like I remember when I was younger, like growing up with my parents who were like liberal Democrats who loved to demonize conservatives. Oh my God, like love it.
They love to hate.
They love to hate. And I certainly felt that. I certainly like hated Republicans. I hated like, and I thought, oh, they're terrible. They're trying to take away, you know, the right to abortion and they're trying to all this stuff. And like, since like really working with this archetype of wholeness, I no longer feel that anymore. Like that has dissolved in me. And I know I don't have the ability to like project super badness onto anybody. Like I can see people doing things that I think are wrong and I can be like, well, those actions are wrong, but I'm not like that group of people is like, oh boy.
You've lost your righteous zeal for hatred, which ultimately is a like enlarging of the capacity for goodness. In an absolute sense.
Yes, definitely. And I'm so, so grateful for it every day. And I feel like, so I feel like that is the fruit of what Crowley's magic succeeded in doing. I feel like he paved the way for the work of Carl Jung and for the widespread realization in like Western consciousness of that the Christ mandala has been completed and you can access the whole of it now, which is the whole self with capital S. You don't have to only access the saintly, miraculous healing parts. You can also access the naughty, naughty parts and know that they are within you and that it's okay because they are completely balanced by the good parts.
Right.
And you don't have to project it anywhere. And so I guess what I see that's exciting, an exciting possibility for the Age of Aquarius, is like, what if everybody grokked that? Everybody got to this kind of integral consciousness and we just stopped projecting evil onto whole other groups of people and stopped feeling the need to murder them and control them and censor them and like wow, wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah, wouldn't it be paradise? Just to let, like, live and let live, acknowledge that equal amounts of ignorance live within you as any other person. Anyone else's weird fucked uppery is equally balanced by weird fucked uppery of some kind in you. And there's really no need to, yeah, fantasize about, like, some, yeah, evil force that could possibly overtake the good. Like, I feel like that's sort of the, I don't know, I feel like that's the real crux of it, is that when we, like, really hate the evil, we imagine that it could somehow overtake the good, and we give it so much power, and then it inevitably sniffs that out and wants some of that, and somehow the, like, balancing of them returns an equal amount of power and, like, yeah, wholeness.
Yeah. And so that's why I love Aleister Crowley. That's why I am just down with him. Like, I just
yeah. Well, and to my knowledge, it's not like Crowley was going around, like, saying that, like, no one should ever do anything good at all and, like, should be completely devoid of virtue and, like, utterly avoid virtue. And, like, paradoxically, you know, this part of force that wills evil and accidentally works good, like, it can't be avoided. Like, virtue is a standing wave that, like, can't actually be toppled. We don't need to, like, paranoidly, like, maintain it at all costs from the assault of evil. Like, it will just, it just exists. It,
yeah,
just is.
It flourishes just like the sun shines. And, you know, yeah, it's I love that, and I find it so interesting. So, like, what was I thinking as you were saying that? About how it does seem, you know, sort of like, definitely like Taoist style, like, if you just, so, like, for example, like, the name, the Great Beast, obviously emphasizes sort of the mammalian dimension of humanity, right? Like, the part of us that just, like, wants to feel good, have good food, good sex, get high, be comfortable, you know, have pleasure. And I think it's been my experience that whenever I have, like, met that mammalianness in myself and been like, oh, well, there you are. Yeah, of course you're there. You're fine. Okay, well, cool. And just, like, not judged it, not tried to, like, get away from it, but just been like, well, this is part of me. Like, then it's like there's a spontaneous desire to develop virtue and to behave in virtuous ways, because it's like, well, you know, it's kind of more interesting. Like, it's sort of like a fun challenge to go after. Whereas if I were constantly shaming myself for my desire for good food, good fun, pleasure, whatever, I know that I would be obsessed with getting those things, and I would behave in way not virtuous, weird, deceitful, sideways manners to get them.
Right.
And I think basically everybody is like, yeah, whenever, like, I don't know, it's been my experience, for example, with Sleepover Mystery School, like, the old school Golden Dawn, which is much of our inspiration, you know, they used to demand really rigorous oaths from people and stuff like that, and we don't do any of that. And, other than silence, you do have to be silent if you join Sleepover Mystery School. You can't be telling people about the rituals. Yeah. That is a secret. But, you know, but
best
the Golden
Dawn
doing. Ones were way more intense. They were like, lightning will strike you, the avenging angel, Hua, will come down upon you if you are not cool to everybody in the group. We don't have anything like that. And what I notice is everybody is super cool to each other.
Yeah.
How about that? Like, yeah, you know, it's just like they're trusted to be excellent to one another, and they just spontaneously are. And that's so lovely.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, somehow the, like, prohibition creates the urge to violate it.
Yes, absolutely. Like, yeah, I mean, how can it not?
How can it not? I know in my own disposition that, like, that's just true. That's just a true fact. Yeah, and it does seem to work better to just have an attitude of trust in people that, like, it's okay.
Yeah, and it's like, when I say that they're excellent to one another, like, has there ever been gossip that has happened? Probably, maybe. Has there ever been a bit of rudeness? Probably. But, like, overall, the vibes are so sweet.
So, like, sweet, so sweet. And, like, I can just see how, like, the prohibition against that creates the, like, fucked up witch hunt, because it's like, you know, you have one rude encounter with another person, or one, you know, heated disagreement. And then suddenly, under the, like, laws of the prohibition, that is, like, a terrible sin. And now, like, we have to, like, root that out and, like, attack that person and, like, make the case for how they have broken the rule and, like, get them out. And, like, oh, suddenly we're just, like, exiling people and, like, cocooning them in, like, the illusion of badness. And it just, like, amplifies the badness, because then that person is put on the defense and has to be like, no, you're bad, you're wrong, you don't understand. And it just, like, magnifies the, like, hate, basically. Whereas if there's just sort of a deep understanding that, like, we all behave in both saintly and unsaintly ways, and I forgive you, it's okay, let's talk about this. Like, nobody has to be, like, brought to justice, because justice naturally occurs. Like, we don't have to be the agents that, like, murder the heretics.
Absolutely. Which is,
like, when there's no heresy, there's no witch hunting.
Exactly. And this is reminding me of, like, the hot topic we started talking about a couple weeks ago, like, the way that, like, the very sort of histrionic prohibition against child abuse or sexuality with children has created this, apparently, according to Whitney Webb's account, this whole
fucking, like, cabal,
insane, like, underground
fascination,
mafia, corporation, like, big tech, government, terrible exploitation and child trafficking that, you know, like, so. I am just, like, there's just a question mark in my mind about, like, what will it take to resolve that and to, like, bring in sanity and reasonableness at the same time protecting children? Because it's, like, obviously that histrionic prohibition is meant to protect children, but it has kind of this reverse effect, as we're talking about, in this kind of Taoist way. And I certainly experienced that reverse effect growing up. Like, there were multiple times when I tried to tell my mother that my father was sexually abusing me, and it was like she could not take that information in, because it would mean, you know, she was married to a monster, she would have to immediately divorce him. So she, instead of, like, being able to hear me, like, basically, like, denied my experience. And, like, I have total forgiveness for her for that. Like, I really understand it was a very difficult position, and she was still in denial about the abuse that she experienced as a child. But I can just really see how that, like, histrionic societal prohibition meant to protect children ended up, like, working on my mother's psyche in such a way that I was actually less protected than I might have been if there was an attitude that was something along the lines of, like, well, you know, it's really not good for anybody to interact that way with kids, and we really don't want them to. And also, apparently, humans are apes that, like, behave in this undesirable way.
Are arguably, like, the horniest apes on the planet, given the number of humans that there are.
And can we find a way to, like, take in this information and hold it not with, like, terrible paranoia and hysterical fear, but in some way that, like, actually enables action to protect children from experiencing the negative consequences of adult humans being apes. Like, so I'm just, there's just, like, a question mark in my mind of, like, what is it going to take for that to happen. And and I can also see like how, like you mentioned your friend who experienced childhood sexual abuse, and yeah. she said that like a lot of the negative part for her was the shame. I think that was also true for me on reflection. Like after you said that, I was like, you know what? Like, definitely far from ideal, the experience itself, definitely like confusing and overwhelming, and would not want any child to experience that. And also the level of societal shame and paranoia that I could sense about it definitely gave me the communication that like something was violated. Something yeah. was wrong. It was so wrong. Right. It was beyond the pale of wrongness.
Right.
And I was involved in it.
Right.
Which had to mean that there was something terribly, terribly wrong and shameful with me.
Right.
Like, there was no way for me to discern, oh, only the wrongness is on the perpetrator, my father.
Right.
Like, it necessarily colored me.
Right.
And I think that that is probably the experience of every child who experiences that and, like, encounters the societal attitude about it of, like, wow, this wrongness that people can't even dare to speak about. People start shaking. They get really weird. They, like, immediately want to murder anybody who, like... This must be mega wrong. And somehow I was involved in it. So what does that say about me?
Right. Yeah.
Thanks, honey. And anyhow, so I'm just like really pondering this because I really want, you know, I want the child trafficking to stop. I want the bizarre blackmail that's running our world to stop. I want humans to be more excellent to one another. And so these are just like sort of open questions in my mind of like what needs to happen for that to happen. But I figured that probably part of what needs to happen is for more people who experience childhood sexual abuse to talk about their experiences with it. So I figured I would talk about it.
Indeed.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, Layla.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, like, just to, like, take it down a notch from, like, the most heinous. Like, I can see how, you know, Thelema encouraged a great amount of, like, free sexual expression and, like, you know, what now we just call ethical non-monogamy or like polyamory or like open relationships or even like homosexuality. Like that stuff is more chill now than it probably ever has been. And it possibly took the like concerted, wicked, evil, antisocial effort of a bunch of strange magicians being like, we're willing to do that to like open up the portal in the collective human psyche for like everyone's freak flag to just be a little bit less of like a terror on the horizon. And like, you know, the amazing sexual liberation of women. And like, and even listening to you talk just now about like your experience of feeling like super bad and wrong, like I can see how in previous eras, like that, you know, sinfulness has like the sinfulness of sex period as like impure has like been cast entirely onto like women as mm-hmm. like, oh, the temptresses and like, oh, and you can see it in, you know, more conservative societies where like women have to completely cover themselves and like just the okaying of the like nasty, awful, terrible, wrong vibration of like carnal desire has actually created more wholesomeness and like space so that it used to be the case that like people who were queer were just like antisocial perverts. Like it's not a perfect, you know, total completion and like elimination of the problem, but like it's like undeniable that there is more space now for like the wholesome holding of everyone's weirdness. And, like, we can acknowledge that, like, people who are homosexual love each other and have wholesome intent towards each other and are not perverts. And, like, I really think that because we're living in the soup of it, like, we can really focus on, like, what's yucky and bad and wrong mm-hmm. still. But, like, compared to 100 years ago or 200 years ago, we're living in a way more
wholesome attitude towards everyone's relationship to carnal pleasure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's another thing, to circle back to our boy Alistair. Like, I'm forgetting the dates exactly, but, you know, Oscar Wilde, within Aleister Crowley's lifetime, was put on trial for his relationship with, what was his name, Alfred Bosley, who he was in love with, who, you know, he wrote poetry about, and they had a very sweet relationship. And anyways, he got put on trial and put in prison for homosexuality, like the most popular playwright in the English-speaking world. And Alistair himself, you know, like, had relationships with, you know, men and women, and, like, did that rather publicly and, like, rather flagrantly, and was, like,
in a very violent, evil fashion at the time.
Yeah, and, like, that was, like, a good part of what had people see him as the wickedest man in the world, was, like, just his willingness to be...
his queerness. And, like, by today's standards, we'd be like, he's bisexual. Big deal.
Yeah,
big
so fucking deal. What? Yeah, exactly.
Obviously not an evil person. And, like, even his, like, heroin addiction, like, at the time, like, you know, back when, people who were suffering from addiction were also considered to be, like, antisocial monsters. And that attitude has completely changed. Like, there is redemption for people, and there is an understanding that, like, that is not evidence of evil and, like, terrible, broken, just possession by the devil.
Right. Like, and at the time that Alistair was using, there were no 12-step programs. There were no drug rehabs as we know them today. I guess there was
sanatoriums. Didn't that come out from the collaboration between Jung and...
Bill W. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, precisely. So again, if we wanted, as I seem to be inclined to do, to give credit to Alistair for making it possible for Carl Jung to access the archetype of the whole self with capital S, then in a way, his addiction and all of his magic and everything connected to that directly, mystically, astrally opened the door for a path of healing for millions and millions of people all around the world. That's incredible. Like, the 12 steps are definitely, like, America's greatest contribution to the spiritual landscape. And, yeah, written directly in conversation with Carl Jung.
Yeah. So, like, today, I mean, it's so interesting, yeah, that, like, the sort of aversion to being associated with Crowley and, like, the reputation that he has is, like, a holdover from the, like, very shaming, hateful attitudes that we actually don't even have as a society anymore. Like, his willingness to be so fucking bad, or, like, anyway, on a magical level, has actually loosened up the world consciousness in a, like, massive way.
Yeah, massive, massive. And, of course, you know, there are many examples we could find of in Crowley's personal life and in his literature where he, like, said misogynistic things, behaved misogynistically. And so he was clearly in conflict with levels of himself. But there was also a part of Alistair that was, like, totally excited about the liberation of women. About, like, women doing whatever the fuck they wanted. You know, the woman girt with a sword. Like,
yeah,
he was so giddy for, you know, like, if women truly wanted terminating their pregnancies, if women truly wanted, you know, having however many lovers they wanted, like, if they wanted to be a Hausfrau, awesome, they could do that. Like, I feel like he was in touch with that possibility and that joy, like, really before very many people were also.
Yeah. So. Maybe his reputation at the time was super shitty, but probably wouldn't be judged. Like, honestly, people would probably like Alistair better today than they would like Jesus.
Yeah, if they met him on the street, yeah.
He would be more relatable.
He would definitely be more relatable, for sure. I mean, that would be amazing. Can you imagine the kind of memes that Alistair would make? The amazing Instagram lives and
incredible
far out emails
he would have such a following.
You would send
such a following.
Well, everybody, thanks for tuning in with us today. It's been fun. I hope this has given you some of our joy and illumination. If you like the podcast, please do follow, like,
subscribe,
leave share a with comment, your friends. Tell your friends. All of that helps us to really spread mystery culture revival in the world. Okay, well, until next time, everybody, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.